Now on Robinhood Radio, it's time for The Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage. David is a multimedia journalist with an online column at themediabeat.us, and he's reported since 2012 on ethical issues for the PBS network. He's also the author of a forthcoming memoir, A Question of Paternity, Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning August 30th, 2024. Both parties' national conventions are a distant vision in the rearview mirror, and taking their place in our newsroom's agendas have been more out-and-about, travelling events, like statewide bus tours and town hall-style meetings, with bigger rallies still to come, just as in any election campaign by the time Labor Day weekend comes around. One slightly unusual element this time has been Kamala Harris and Tim Walz sitting down together last night for a somewhat rare joint twosome interview, conducted by Dana Bash of CNN, the news network conveniently headquartered in Atlanta, that pulsing blue urban heart, amid the distinctly redder outer districts of its state, Georgia, of course, through which the pair's bus tour was ploughing its way. Such a tactical statewide push is reminiscent of Bill Clinton and Al Gore's sweep through rural Georgia in 1992. It was irreverently called at the time the, quote, Bubba's for Bill tour. But they had the last laugh. Clinton successfully beat George H.W. Bush in Georgia by a tiny squeak of a margin, 0.59%, the closest result of any state that year. The Harris campaign is now trying to build on the bolstering it has received from the other side, from, for instance, high-profile Republican turncoats like Stephanie Grisham, who was an advisor to both Donald and Melania Trump during their term in the White House. She told everyone at Chicago that Trump calls people who vote for him, he called them in private, that is, quote, basement dwellers, unquote. It's a curious epithet to apply to a class of people, especially your own supporters, but perhaps it's unsurprising, coming from the lips of a man who inhabits gilded high-rise triplexes and gaudily extravagant country clubs. Other high-ranking GOP defectors spoke in Chicago, of course, and since then, we have now had a pretty neat scoop by USA Today, the much-underestimated national semi-tabloid newspaper, with its first reporting of 200-plus staffers, alums, the paper calls them, of the George W. Bush administration and the Mitt Romney and John McCain campaigns, signing on to a public expression of support for Harris and a protest against Trump as, quote, simply untenable, unquote, for the presidency. Ballyhooed publicity-winning moves like that are, of course, useful to the Harris-Walz campaign, but it's becoming clearer and clearer as we go down the road that much more important is the old Bill Clinton adage, it's the economy, stupid. The venerable polling organization Gallup regularly asks voters, what do you think is the most important problem facing this country today? And through each cycle, the responses are extraordinarily consistent across many different population groups and ethnicities. It's the economy, it's wages, it's the rising cost of living. And that remains true no matter how much Democrats can point to a falling rate of inflation. Prices, especially everyday items like groceries and housing costs, are still higher than people remember from before. And those concerns are rife among the group of voters with whom Harris could be said to be doing best of all, what's loosely called the youth vote. 40 million members of Generation Z will be eligible to vote this year. That includes about 8 million who'll have just reached voting age and are voting for their first time. Very nearly half of them will be young people of color, including almost 9 million Latinos, almost 6 million black youth, almost 2 million Asian Americans, and another 2 million multiracial youth. Here is a crucial pool of voters, though they should never be thought of as a block vote, certainly not monolithic. The young are recorded by pollsters as breaking decisively toward Harris. And here's one non-polling-based, unscientific indicator of that being true. Trump is recognizing his deficit in this age group, so much so that he decided to make one very interesting media choice. He appeared on Theo Von's podcast this past weekend. That's the comedian and former so-called reality TV performer. Von is known familiarly as the Rat King, and he's evidently favorite listening material for Baron Trump, the candidate's college-aged son, fathered with Melania. The 78-year-old candidate and his relatively youthful interlocutor, about half Trump's age, chatted about the relative merits of cocaine and alcohol, UFC fighting, healthcare, and immigration issues. No great swing in the polls toward Trump came from this niche appearance, but then how could it? A statistical trend is in process. An Axios Generation Lab poll showed that 18 to 29-year-olds are dividing 60% for Harris and 40% for Trump, giving Harris a 20-point lead. That gap is growing. Certainly, according to a poll by the group Voters of Tomorrow, itself evidently concentrates on the youth vote, and I should acknowledge it's a partisan advocacy group headed by young people themselves. Its poll showed that since the Axios findings, Harris has gone on to surpass Trump by a whopping 32 points in that same age group. And significantly, this poll was focused on young people living in 7 battleground states. A more granular approach than people's simple binary choice has been taken by the New York Times opinion section. They've engaged in some pretty deep delving that smacks more of focus grouping than simple polling. Interviews of some length and then repeated more than once with young people from a range of backgrounds and persuasions, including, most importantly, no stated choice of a candidate they'd support. The Times' method appears considerably more sophisticated than when I was sent out to sample public opinion as a young TV reporter in London, standing with a microphone and camera on a windswept street corner and accosting random passers-by. What is especially telling about the Times' effort is that it reveals a dynamic process in play over time. Many of the young people interviewed had previously had a little regard for Harris, and yet they have more regard now, even considerable enthusiasm for her. One case in point is Ben, a 20-year-old student from Michigan, who was quite negative about the vice president before the convention. He saw her as untrustworthy. He said, "I would ask Harris to describe what makes her qualified to be president." Using an approval scale of 1 to 10, he gave her a 3 before the convention, but after her speech, he doubled it to a 6. He said, "I like that she shaped her whole speech around looking forward instead of looking backward. What made me do was compare her speech to Trump's. I liked hers a lot better." That kind of shift may well offer comfort to the Harris campaign, but there's a catch, always is with this sector of the electorate. A somewhat impressive 2/3 of the 18 to 34-year-old segment said, in that Voters of Tomorrow poll, that they are, quote, "very likely or certain to be voting in November." But our actual experience suggests repeatedly every 4 years that they don't fully follow through with such intentions on voting day. Possibly a much more reliable catch would be somewhat older people, and especially valuable would be blue-collar voters who are swingable away from any earlier Trump loyalty. They're certainly a bullseye target for the Democrats' tacticians. We could see the setting up of that broad targeting in the convention's careful showcasing. Very prominent was Kyle Sweetser, a steelworker who runs a construction business in Mobile, Alabama. He previously voted for Trump 3 times over, he said. He now, rather famously, told the delegates, "I work in construction. I work with my hands. Trump told us he would look out for blue-collar workers. I donated to him many times through his presidency." But, and Sweetser's speech was built upon this but, "I started to see Trump's tariff policy in action, and costs for construction workers like me were starting to soar. I realized Trump wasn't for me. He was for lining his own pockets." And Sweetser concluded, "Now, I'm not left-wing, period. But I believe our leaders should bring out the best in us, not the worst. That's why I'm voting for Kamala Harris." There's inevitably a mounting urgency in this pursuit of the possibly undecided blue-collar vote. Tim Walz, who now wears the mantle of chief Democratic Union guy, now that Scranton Joe Biden has stepped aside, had to hop away from the Georgia bus tour to address the nation's firefighters gathering in Boston. Their very sizable union, along with the even bigger Teamsters, is still officially uncommitted in its presidential choice, though interestingly the Black Caucus of Firefighters has endorsed Harris Walz. As an indicator of how edgy this tussle has become, the Teamsters' leader, Sean O'Brien, who shocked many traditionally minded union members by addressing Trump's followers at the Republicans' Milwaukee convention, did not, wasn't allowed to, speak also in Chicago. Theoretically, at least, the Teamsters' vote is still up for grabs. And it remains vital. The senior Harris organizer, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, who's the granddaughter of the union hero Cesar Chavez, put it pointedly this week. The thing about organized labor is that it is organized. It can deliver votes. Insufficient numbers, the campaign will have to hope. At the back of all this jockeying, it's unavoidably the split between blue-collar and white-collar, or what is sometimes over-neatly called the diploma divide, that remains fundamental to American voting patterns, whether we like it or not. The perpetually reliable Pew Center's research work recorded once again in 2020 that out of Americans with a college degree, 61% voted Democrat, while out of those who didn't have a college degree, a smaller majority, but still substantial, 53%, favored the Republicans' Trump. And who can forget Trump's own well-noted and unadorned assessment when he was first progressing via the Nevada caucuses toward being a candidate 8 years ago? He said then, with more than a touch of pride about it, "I love the poorly educated." That's all from the Media Bit this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.